IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
And welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm Anushka Saxena, a research analyst with Takshashila Institution's Indo-Pacific Studies program. And today I'll be quizzing Manoj Kevalramani, the chairperson of the program and fellow China Studies, on some key issues emerging from the recently concluded Munich Security Conference and Chinese diplomacy at the conference. Happy to have you here, Manoj.
Hi, Anushka. Thanks. Good to be here.
Right. So, the 2024 edition of the Munich Security Conference, like I said, just concluded on the 18th of February. It's 3 days of over 80 countries being represented by leaders, entrepreneurs, and other stakeholders. And the deliberations that have been taking place in Munich, Germany, since 1963 as part of this conference. And in the 2024 edition, discussions surrounded key issues plaguing the global economy and the security architecture, ranging from non-traditional security challenges like climate change, leaps in tech, to tensions in the US-China relationship and the impacts of the Russia-Ukraine and Israel-Gaza wars. And so in a way, I think the significance of the conference is that it becomes crucial to understand what exactly worries a majority of the economies and largely Western economies, both on the security and economic front, and other key nations like Japan, China, and Ukraine, who were also vehement participants at the conference this year. So to delve right into this, Manoj, I think my first question to you would be, on these key themes that have emerged from the overall discussions at the Munich Security Conference, as well as how they're highlighted in the conference report, what do you perceive has Europe worried? Like on security specifically, the Munich Security Conference report argues that we're now in an era where the risk of great power competition is maximized and the optimism of the early post-Cold War era has dissipated. So do you think that this reflects Europe's highly securitized lens of the world order at this juncture? And what worries them? Is it about having to make tough choices, which is very difficult for the EU as a whole to make? Or is it about not being able to keep up with rivalrous developments? Over to you, Manoj.
Right. So, Anushka, you asked me what worries Europe and what comes across in the report. And obviously, not just this report, but even previous last few years of the Munich Security Conference. To me, honestly, what worries Europe, and I'm going to be very blunt about this, is irrelevance. There is a certain amount of, if you just go back to the last few years Munich Security Conferences, there was a sense of helplessness as one theme. There was revision as one theme, which was revisionism by Russia and others. And today we've got the theme of this conference was lose-lose. And before that, a few years before that, it was westlessness. And so the idea of Europe unable to grapple with or struggling to grapple with changes that are taking place across the geopolitical and geoeconomic landscape. I think that's what's reflected repeatedly in these conferences. Today, Europe finds itself in a position where there's been over 2 years of war in Europe. There is no real answer in sight as to how you're going to address that conflict and how you're going to resolve that conflict. That has led to a number of European security states increasing their at least committing to increase their security expenditures. But to be able to meet your security needs, there's a lot that needs to be done over a long period of time. It's going to take time. It's going to take money. At the same time, the relationship between Europe and the United States, you know, as much as the war in Ukraine under Biden has galvanized the relationship between Europe and the United States, it's not necessary that it's been all smooth sailing. There have been frictions around the CHIPS, Science and CHIPS Act, around the Inflation Reduction Act, around industrial policy, around engaging with China. On some of these things, transatlantic ties have been tested, but they've managed. But there are deep frictions, right? There is a rise of populism and right-wing revival in Europe in some ways. I mean, Netherlands is an example of that right now. In the United States, you're likely to see a very difficult year heading into the presidential elections with the potential of Trump coming to power. As an American diplomat, former American diplomat who was part of a conversation that I was part of recently, said that when you discuss this possibility with the Europeans, it's usually, it feels like a session of therapy because that's what they need. So to me, there is this sense of anxiety. The rise of China on the one side, the rise of the global south on the one side, which the report talks about. It mentions that that over the next 10 years, they do see the global south collectively and China, of course, being rising actors, whereas there is a sense of decline among the G7 countries. So I think that anxiety of what one can call the old order, struggling to adapt to what is a new changed environment and which is rapidly evolving. I think that's what is generally reflected in the conversations and the debates. And I do think that unless and until European states can start thinking about the world beyond a Eurocentric lens, and try and think of the world in terms of engaging with the dynamism of countries in this part of the world, thinking about their security being linked to this part of the world, and perhaps also developing a certain degree of autonomy and capacity. Autonomy will be a product of capacity. Unless they can do that, this sense of anxiety will prevail, because you're not necessarily able to make decisions which are within necessarily your own interests. Your interests are so intricately tied to other actors. Say with regard to China and the US, Europe is sort of caught in the middle. So I think that to me is the prevailing sense, is that there is an inability to address what seem to be core problems for you, and your capability. You've just woken up to the fact that your capability is so deeply eroded, while others seem to have caught up or are rising, and your nature of your economies have completely shifted, and you're struggling on all ends, from a social lens, political sense, economic sense, and geopolitical sense. And I think that's what usually, in the last at least 4 or 5 years, and even so this year, is reflected in the Munich Security Conference.
Manoj, I think that makes a lot of sense because, you use the word old order, and it does seem as if from the European narrative that is presented year on year at the conference, that there is a sense of losing out on the old order where a lot of the security and economic dynamics of the global order were in Europe's control per se. And like you said, there are these actors that are evolving with the dynamics of the times, and Europe may be feeling like it's losing out. And I think on this front, this year, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Christoph Hüsgen, who's a German ambassador, also had an agenda to include the global south more in these conversations at the conference, because otherwise they can tend to get more Europe or West-centric. But to me, the way in which this focus was presented was really odd. For example, in the MSC report again, in the tech section, many states in the global south still prioritize digital development over geopolitical alignment. And the tone is as if the global south is being rebuked for not securitizing development and not looking after themselves. And similarly, the significance of ASEAN in the section on, say, the Indo-Pacific has been shown only to be as an ally of either the US or China. So is this win-win or like you said, lose-lose mentality really Europe's I don't know, biggest enemy at this point in time? And how does this restricted vision of the global South impact Europe's overall agenda to, say, progress in any field, economics, technology, security?
Right. So, I mean, look, again, I go back to this idea of looking at the last 5 years, you know, of the reports of this Munich Security Conference. And what you will see is, I mean, I just quickly run you through the 5 years titles, right? There was Westlessness, which is the world becoming less Western? And what could be a Western strategy for an era of great power competition? This is obviously the year where the pandemic had hit. That just about hit. And Europe was still not affected, although China was affected. And COVID, was creating this concern. The next year, we had this thing of cooperation and competition, which was the idea of democracies against autocratic systems of rule, and that sort of a competition. The year following that, you had unlearning helplessness, which was again about systems competition, collective sense of helplessness because of global challenges. And you can see a pattern developing here, right? And then there was a revision, which is, revisionist autocratic regimes trying to break down the liberal democratic principles and that order is prevailing. And then what you have this year is lose-lose. So what you can also see is why I sort of say that this is an old order sort of thinking is because there's a lot of focusing on the problem as opposed to thinking about what do we do. And a lot of the what do we do is around this identity of the West, as opposed to necessarily the identity of something being global. Now, you talked about the global South being mentioned and mentioned in this context of, its problem is that it's not looking at a securitization. Of course, it can't because it needs access to opportunities. Countries in the global South are going to prioritize development because for them, development is intricately linked to security. Water sanitation in poor countries is a security problem as much as it is anything else. Health is a severe security problem. So it is intricately linked because you need to uplift standards of living. And I think that conception is something that is not understood. For them, the creation of these boundaries that are taking place, which are part of our geopolitical and geoeconomic reality today, that globalization is going to be somewhat segmented, is problematic. And therefore, they will articulate against it and they will argue as much as against it. And countries like China will sort of use that as much as possible to try and make the case that, look, this is the West essentially politicizing what should be normal economic actions under the garb of security, because even China stands to gain from opener access to, greater access to talent, capital, markets. As much as it wants to shield itself from its own, from the competition from the West. So, so it's fair for the global South to make that case that, look, for us, it's a problem. Now, as much as Europe is talking about, when it comes to the United States, the Europeans tend to worry about securitization of certain kinds of practices. Yet Europe is itself pursuing securitization of certain sectors. I mean, for example, when, and different kinds of protectionist measures. So the carbon tax on imports in Europe is something which is going to be a protectionist measure. When you're going to apply, when you're suddenly going to engage in anti-subsidy probes against certain countries, and they're doing that against China, and very clearly Chinese electronic vehicles are subsidized heavily by the state. But in a world where everybody's pursuing industrial policy, and does anti-subsidy investigation make any sense in that sense? So I think it's much more complicated. Yet the fundamental challenge for Europe is how does it see its own role in what is a new world order that is emerging, particularly when it does not have any more the economic dynamism that, say, countries in Asia and even the United States to some degree has. It does not have the security capabilities that a United States and increasingly a China has. That it does not have the resource capabilities or the ability to engage in resource competition, which, say, the Chinese and the Americans are today engaged in. And I think it is that struggle of coming to terms with this changed reality and where do you fit into this, which is, I think, what's taking place.
Yeah, right. I mean, the Global South's emphasis on development should have been seen as an opportunity in Europe, just like it is being seen, say, in the US or even or in China, of course. And that a lot of that has been reflected in Chinese diplomacy with, say, Wang Yi's meetings on the sidelines with countries like Mongolia, Argentina, and otherwise also. But clearly, that's not the case because of the almost, like you pointed out, imperial pattern of themes that become evident from this conference. And even on, say, the example of the carbon tax that you took, it's clear that Europe's protectionist policies are in a way not just meant to enhance its own sense of, say, catching up, that we're now finally looking inwards in a manner that we can protect national security and our own economy in a way that, say, other countries are, but also pulling down those that will be disproportionately impacted from taxes like these. For example, countries that still do a lot of carbon intensive work like China and even India will face higher export pricing vis-a-vis their markets in Europe. And so the developmental priorities are clearly shaken up at the moment. And speaking of China, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, he delivered a keynote speech and it was titled Firmly Acting as a Force for Stability in a Turbulent World. And, you know, this was part of a specific session at the MSC, which is China in the World, which is really interesting. So was there anything in particular that you found important to note or some repeated phrases that call our attention in Wang Yi's keynote address?
Yeah, I mean, my sort of quick take on the keynote address by Wang Yi was that it was predictable. There was nothing particularly new. I mean, if you've been following Chinese diplomacy, then there was nothing particularly new that he was saying and that stood out or that felt like something that was unique, that something that was a new intervention that China was making or a new proposition that China was offering. I think it was a lot of more of the same. Some key points that he made was that with regard to the US, he projected a certain degree of optimism given the Biden-Xi Jinping meeting in San Francisco in November last year. And he talked about the need for, you know, obviously the relationship to be going forward from there. He repeated the framing of, you know, we need to adhere to mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, win-win cooperation. On Russia, I thought knowing the fact that there will be a pushback from Europe around China's relationship with Russia, he was sort of quite clear that, look, this is an important relationship. This is a I thought that his phrasing when he began by saying Russia is China's largest neighboring country, I think that is something that everybody needs to keep in mind from a Chinese point of view. The Chinese will make that case that, look, our relationship with Russia is not just about the West. It's also about our boundary with Russia and the fact that we are each other's largest neighbors in that sense. But he talked about the fact that this is a relationship, again, interesting use of words, that is growing on the basis of, quote, non-alliance, non-confrontation, and non-targeting any third party. So this is him sort of giving Europe the message that, yes, we are friends, but we're not really, there is some daylight between our positions around the world. From India's point of view, I think it was interesting that he said that this relationship serves the strategic stability of the Asia-Pacific region, the world at large, yes, but the Asia-Pacific region, which I think is something for India to think about because Russia's partnership with China has implications for the Indo-Pacific and is not just about Europe or the US. So in India, we need to keep that in mind. An interesting message that he delivered with regard to Europe, which again, I don't think is new, but he made this point clear in all bilaterals that he had with European leaders also, that Europe sort of needs to stay away and stay clear of any geopolitical or ideological distractions and must see China as a partner rather than rival. So this has been long-standing effort as Beijing sees the world moving, drifting towards some sort of a Cold War-style situation, although not exactly a Cold War, in that it wants to, again, create some degree of distance, exploit the fissures that exist between the transatlantic partners. So this has been Beijing's pitch for long, and I think he doubled down on that. he talked about Israel and Palestine. He talked about other specific issues, which if you want, we can get into. But the two other key points that I think he sent were, I think the one sort of big point was that China would be happy to establish a work with others for an international AI governance institution that can be established under the UN framework. He reiterated Chinese position on Taiwan. And he made the case that de-risking is a dead end. So if you're thinking of de-risking, it's not really going to work. Again, none of this is really new, apart from perhaps this proposition for agreement for an AI governance institution. But the rest of it is sort of par for the course. So there was nothing really new to offer, but a reiteration of some key themes. He made, in his speech, he also made a big section, which I've not covered, which he talked about the Chinese economy. And he talked about how China's economy is stabilizing and it's going to continue to improve over the period of time. So it's a long-term bet that one must make on China economically. And again, that's not a new message, but it's an important message given the weakness that the Chinese economy is currently suffering. He also, I think that the key tone of the speech was not confrontational. He was clearly making what are points that have been made in the past without necessarily engaging in what one would have called wolf warriorism. And to me, that is likely to remain the hallmark of the Chinese foreign policy for this year. If you go back to December last year, you had the Central Foreign Affairs Work Conference, and then Xi Jinping gave a speech to Chinese diplomats. And I think in that, it was not so subtle by Xi Jinping, where he was indicating that stylistically, we need to calm down. And I would wager that that is perhaps a lot linked to the backlash that Beijing has faced, but also to the economic headwinds that China is currently facing. So to me, that was largely what Wang Yi was saying.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
Lot of interesting points, and you know, the Lunar New Year time period is also very interesting, both vis-a-vis China's engagement at Davos and even the Munich Security Conference, to talk about how China's economic numbers are stabilizing. But yes, at the same time, it's also I think important to note that there is an acknowledgement that this is going to be a long-term bet, precisely because of the very structural changes that are now underway vis-a-vis moving the Chinese economy away from only being export-oriented to being complemented by export, but being led by internal demand and consumption. And so if I can come back to the US-China relationship bit, you know, like I said, Wang, he had many meetings on the sidelines with the UK, EU, US, France, Mongolia, Argentina, and even Ukraine. And then the readouts came out, and as per the Chinese readout of the US-China meeting on the sidelines of the conference, you know, it pointed out, like you said, the optimism vis-a-vis relations. There were discussions on military-to-military ties, counter-narcotics. Some of these were aspects. These were channels of communication and dialogue that were stopped 2 years ago with Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taipei, but now seem to be resuming and gaining traction again. Like you said, Wang Yi also talked about sanctions backfiring. But from the US's readout, it doesn't seem like they're reciprocating on China's demand and calls for mutual respect, abandoning Cold War mentality, so on and so forth. So does this meeting or anything discussed at this meeting paint a positive or even a stabilizing picture for the relationship going forward, considering it's one of the key issues? US-China relations and the tensions within are one of the key issues that are highlighted, at have been highlighted at every conference we've seen in the past few years, from the Shangri-La dialogue to the APEC summit, and now even the Munich Security Conference.
Yeah, I mean, interesting question, right? When I read the readout from both the sides, when I read the Chinese readout, my first thought was that, I mean, the first one of the first lines says something like, the two sides had a candid, substantive, and constructive meeting. And then the rest, and then thereafter that, the readout launches us into this whole diatribe by Wang Yi, where he's basically wagging his finger and complaining about everything that China has usually complained about, which is, you know, the US must take an objective and a rational view of China. It must, you know, Americans must be implementing Biden's commitments. It must sort of not support Taiwan independence. It must abide by the One China principle. It must not engage in de-risking or building, small yards with high fences. De-risking is de-sinicization. It must lift unilateral sanctions. It must stop the unwarranted harassment of Chinese citizens. So it's a big bunch of complaints. And after that, you get this thing. Well, this both sides also spoke very highly of the narcotics cooperation group and expressed expectations of, you know, law enforcement cooperation meetings. And both sides will continue to promote their consultations on this whole range of issues that were agreed upon during the Biden-Xi Jinping meeting. And they talked about Ukraine, Gaza, Korean Peninsula, and other issues. I think that what you take away from that is, firstly, both sides are committed to talking. And for all the finger wagging that is going on, which is a product of this fundamental competition that is likely to persist between the two sides for a long period of time. At present, both sides are talking. That is not a sign of trust. That is a sign of recognition that both need to engage with each other, even on the Chinese side, despite whatever finger wagging is going on. Secondly, I think Beijing has acceded to certain American demands through the creation of some of these groups. Now, that is an acceptance in terms of form. You've created these groups. What these groups achieve, we'll have to wait and see. Do they have sufficient time to achieve something? We'll have to wait and see, because you have elections in the US in November. So that's, again, something that's significant. In this year, what we do know is going to happen is that you're going to see, again, a range of senior officials of both sides meeting, different meetings at working group levels that will happen. So that dialogue is going to continue. And what this meeting said was that the dialogue will continue, that there will be high-level visits that will happen, and therefore both sides will continue to meet each other. So I think what you take away from this meeting, again, is what you perhaps take away from an earlier meeting also of these of high-level diplomats, is that both sides see value in engaging. Both sides want to downplay as much as possible any unforeseen events that might break this chain of dialogue. And, you know, just today there was a story in, I think, the Financial Times, which talked about how a former American intelligence official talking about how the Biden administration has systematically not shared information of these Chinese spy balloons with allies and others in the past. So it tells you that there is a desire among both sides to not let things derail what may be a stabilizing conversation, while acknowledging that there is going to be a very difficult process to stabilize this relationship, because at the core of it is this nature is deep competition. And this deep competition is not just a product of, you know, how the two countries view their futures, but also because of how domestic politics in both these countries is increasingly playing out. That there are constituencies that don't necessarily see a stable relationship possible. And that's going to mean that it's going to be a difficult relationship. So I think that to me is what I take away from this meeting. In terms of tangible takeaway, it's that you're likely to see more high-level visits between Chinese and American officials in meetings. Let's see whether they come up with something substantive in the working groups that have been established through last year. And again, let's see if those working groups survive a potential election in November in America.
Right. The domestic politics bit is really interesting, because even at the outset, if it seems like China is a bipartisan kind of an issue with a bipartisan consensus that it is a challenge and has to be dealt with, it may not necessarily be so once one gets into the nitty-gritties of domestic politics in the US, because with Trump regaining presidency, it is possible that we see a waning of the commitment, at least the verbal commitment that has been expressed by Biden to Taiwan. We may see the US-China relationship again becoming securitized, but from a transactional point of view, and not necessarily from a, absolutely all stakes involved rivalry. And so it could go either way with Trump's re-election. On the Ukraine-China front, again, this was another meeting that Wang Yi had on the sidelines with Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, which also revealed that there is a global peace process in the works, and the peace summit is scheduled to be held in Switzerland. Like you said, Wang Yi in his address, as usual, called for peace, safe evacuation of Chinese citizens from Ukraine and Russia. But anything new that we learned from China's stance on the Russia-Ukraine war throughout Wang Yi's engagements? And of course, the EU and US continue to emphasize that China is supporting Russia and not really contributing to the peace process. So do you think that is the case, or is the China-Russia relationship, especially in the context of the Ukraine war, a little bit more nuanced, and there are some important nuances that the West perhaps is missing?
Yeah, look, I look at China's engagement on the Ukraine war as fundamentally doing what is in Chinese interests, as opposed to necessarily just supporting the Russians. I mean, yes, it is in China's interest to see the Russians not lose. And therefore, it is in China's interest to see the Russians push back against NATO. It is in China's interest to see some sort of a new arrangement which creates fissures between Europe and the United States. It is in China's interest to sort of have revisions in the global order, which erodes certain norms which it finds problematic, or it reshapes those norms. And to all of those extents, China works with Russia economically, militarily, from a propaganda point of view, and diplomatically. But does China necessarily want to see this war being prolonged? I mean, maybe not, and I don't think from very early on their position has been that the war is in our interest. The war puts them in a difficult spot because Europe is again a partner that they want to woo, and they don't want to alienate the Russians. So it's put them in a difficult spot, but what they've done is an ungainly balancing act, which I think still continues. I mean, in the meeting, to me it was fascinating when Wang Yi is telling the Ukrainian foreign minister that, we see our two countries as strategic partners, and regardless of how the international situation changes, China hopes that our bilateral ties will develop normally. It's obviously not normal, given the nature of it. I mean, the fact that Xi Jinping has not had a conversation with Vladimir Zelensky tells you that it's not normal, right? So the idea that Wang Yi is making some of these comments, I mean, you've got to take them with a bag of salt. The second thing is that he talked about China's position on the Ukraine issue. There is really nothing new in that. He's basically, again, made the case that, look, Beijing will not be selling weapons and it'll continue to push for peace talks. But Beijing's agenda for peace talks is very clear, which is that peace talks must fundamentally be about creating a new European security architecture. It is not about recognizing Russian aggression. It does not even in its domestic discourse call it a war. Right, so at least in the conventional way, so it calls it this conflict that's taking place. It doesn't even call it an invasion. So I think that it's very, very careful in that context, and I think that that continues to remain the Chinese position. As far as the peace summit goes, I mean, there have been visits by European officials to China and to India to discuss the possibility of some sort of a summit. When I think about it, I don't see why Beijing would want to commit itself publicly to such a summit, particularly if Russia is not on the table. If Russia is on the table and the dialogue is about not just ending the war in Ukraine and the status of the territories that Russia today occupies, along with, of course, Crimea, but if the discussion is about that, along with a new security architecture in Europe in terms of what is NATO's position, what is NATO's, how is NATO's expansion going to be curtailed, what are the threats and in terms of deployment of certain kinds of weapons in certain forward countries, I think Beijing would then want to be on the table. But unless some of those aspects, which are broader, are on the table for discussion, I don't see the value from Chinese perspective to be on the table. Because what is it that Beijing stands to gain? If it is to act as Russia's proxy on the table, in European minds, it cements its position as a pro-Russian actor, as opposed to somebody who's tried to project itself as neutral, as not adding fuel to the fire, as principled, and so on and so forth. So I don't see the value from Beijing's interest perspective to be on the table unless the discussion is about broader issues along with the future of Ukraine and the future of the occupied territories by Russia. So I think that if that is where the case is, you'll probably see Beijing interested. If not, you'll not see Beijing interested. So far, I mean, I was reading a Reuters report in the morning, which talked about the fact that China has attended at least one of the preparatory meetings about around this summit. It has not in public endorsed the Ukrainian 10-point peace plan. Even this meeting, the Chinese readout did not even refer to the Ukrainian peace plan or any desire to engage with that idea. It was not at all critical of Russia, and it's unlikely to be. So, but when I think from a realistic perspective, I don't see the value of being on the table for China unless there are broader issues that are being discussed. And I don't see that being the case. So unless that happens, I don't see why China would be on the table. And if it would be on the table, it probably will be in a position where it hurts itself much more.
Right. On the question of the West perceiving some countries are China's proxies or China can act as a proxy for another country, there was an interesting point again made in one of Wang Yi's other bilaterals with the UK, where the UK requested Wang Yi and China to put pressure on Iran to stop the Houthis from aggravating the situation in the Red Sea and contributing in a way to the overall disorder in the Middle East. And so do you think that is a feasible ask, or does it not really reflect the true picture of the China-Iran relations, or even the kind of control China exercises on the situation in the Middle East?
Look, I mean, it's quite clear that if there is one country which has significant ties with, Iran and the Arab countries in the region, it is China. It has a very close relationship with these countries. It has deep economic ties also. With Iran in particular, China and Russia are key interlocutors, although Russia, of course, has its own problems. So China is a key interlocutor. We know that the United States, the Biden administration reached out to Beijing to work together on some aspects with regard to this particular issue. And they didn't necessarily find a really enthusiastic partner in Beijing. So as much as David Cameron, and whether that's a product of capability or whether that's a product of willingness, it's really difficult to say. I think Beijing has interests in the Red Sea. It does not want to see the spillover of the conflict and further instability in the region. Yet, I think there is a strategic value that Beijing sees the current conflict in the region and the current turmoil deriving the Chinese interests in the context of the fact that you have increasingly Arab states viewing the West as deeply problematic, as deeply negligent with regard to what's happening in Gaza. That is not to say that the Arab states are necessarily proactively taking in people from Gaza and, helping resolve the conflict. They are also weighing their interests. But the ire is easily turned towards the West. And China finds that useful. It has been leveraging that through its diplomatic engagement and its narrative engagement. So I think that's likely to persist because a strategic gain is what China is looking at. As far as the Red Sea tensions go, if things spill out of control, yes, China has significant economic stakes and reasons to be engaged. And I presume what it would rather look at is what sort of force capabilities it needs to or should or can thus deploy in the region to protect its interests, rather than necessarily just pressurizing the Iranians to assuage Western concerns. So I think that, yes, I mean, the United States did reach out to Beijing also, and now David Cameron has made that very public call. But I don't necessarily think that you will see Beijing, heeding any of these calls. I mean, it will do what is in its interest. And if the if it finds that there is an escalation which is troubling China's immediate interests, there will be some sort of, you know, persuasion with regard to the Iranians. If not, I don't think you will see Beijing working at the behest of anybody in the West.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And the point about Beijing rethinking force capabilities in the region from a self-interest perspective is really unique, considering the fact that China has these ambitions to build a blue water navy, and any presence in the Red Sea region and complemented with the fact that a lot of the countries in the region also look to China to provide security support and act responsibly as a great power, could mean that there is investment in aspects such as counter-piracy, deblockading of crucial trade passageways, so on and so forth. So that's a really unique point. One final question, Manoj, before I conclude this episode. So overall, on the Indo-Pacific front, Europe has been seeing China's rise, its push to create a China-centric regional order, and the economic and security concerns emerging from the US-China relationship as some of the key concerns highlighted. And it seems like the China challenge has been articulated at almost every stage in the past few years, but the space to find innovative solutions is reducing significantly. And then this will lead to challenges that EU has seen in the past, like being stuck in the middle of cooperating with China because it's their largest economic partner, but also being forced into looking at China as solely a challenge because of the EU-US relationship as well. So even though the fact of the matter is that the EU policy vis-a-vis China is in some shambles, do you have some thoughts on which strategies are likely to fail and which are likely to succeed in EU's engagement with China?
Right. I mean, I would be very, I don't think I'm in a position to offer any recommendations to European leaders. But what I can say is that it's a difficult and tricky situation that one finds themselves in. And what one needs to try and do is figure out where you can expand your choices. And if those choices mean that you need to engage with China on certain kinds of economic issues, I mean, the first thing to do when you start to calibrate your choices is to see where are your strengths. And Europe's strengths, obviously, there is a certain, I mean, the security, I don't think necessarily is something that Europe today can, I mean, it can't be a serious security actor in a true sense in the Indo-Pacific, but it can do significant signaling. And I think there has been more of that, but there can always be much more. There can be more presence in the region from a security point of view. Secondly, it is important for Europe to take positions when it comes to partners that it wants to deepen their relationship with. So, for example, with India, and again, there has been a gradual shift where the India-US trade relationship, the India-US security relationship has been deepening. But it's not necessarily with the EU as a whole. It's been with specific countries who have been close partners. So France, for example, is a close Indian partner, and it continues to be a close Indian partner. So I think that is the other part. The third thing is that when it comes to your strength is you need to look at it inward. Europe today is in turmoil inward. Its own social dynamics, when the shift to the right, this frustration with migration, all those challenges need to be addressed. The sort of economic stagnation that it finds itself in is something that needs to be addressed. Whether that requires greater industrial policy, whether that requires greater security spending, whether that requires changes in economic policy with regard to labor, whether that actually requires potentially opening up far more to skilled migrants. those are the kinds of decisions that you'll have to sort of engage in. You'll have to think about what is it that builds your strength, because at current, the current sort of trajectory in which most European countries are in, it's stagnation. You will need some dynamism which may come from these different features, whether it is more spending, whether it is more focus on new drivers of growth, whether it is focused on new infusion of human capital. You will need to do some of those things to try and drive growth. And with, and a lot of that goes with domestic legislation, which is a challenge. So I think that to me is the beginning. Now in that, you can engage with partners to try and find pathways where you can, you know, you can address the challenge of getting skilled labor without necessarily it becoming a migration problem. You can work together with dynamic companies through special purpose channels between countries or between groups of countries to try and create opportunities in new technology development and resource, access to resources, access to markets and things like that. So I think it needs to be, there needs to be sort of reimagination that needs to happen in Europe around, and which to be fair, has happened under the Biden administration in the US. The investment in American infrastructure, the investment in American science and technology, all of those are key things that have happened. America's problem is obviously its own polarization, but I think that Europe needs to reimagine itself. And there has been this Green New Deal, but the bureaucracy between the EU and individual member states, the security challenges that Europe now faces, the lack of commitment to spend on your own security, all of those things need to change fast for Europe to become a much more, for it to emerge as a pole. In what is a new multipolar order with that is emerging, with obviously each pole not being of the same capacity, not having the same levels of power. But if Europe wants to be a significant pole, it will need to make some of these investments going forward. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm not, that's me just riffing as opposed to me giving any serious recommendations to European leaders. I'm sure they know better about what they have to do in their countries than I do.
Right. No, but generally, that's a lot of interesting sets of recommendations and a lot of hard questions to grapple with as well. There is obviously an ideological component where the European Union indeed has to let go of some of the conceptions, say, vis-a-vis restlessness or revisionism, and at the same time also has to really make a significant investment, both financially and in terms of partnerships with key stakeholders, if it has to grapple with perceived vulnerabilities. And of course, there is a combined ideological and action plan component to it, which is that there has to be a differentiation between what is really a challenge to the EU and where it can find middle ground and solutions. For example, constructing labor deals and with partners that it has good relations with without necessarily inviting a migration issue. On that note, we come to the end of this podcast episode. Thank you so much, Manoj. Your insights were really delightful. And thank you also to our listeners for staying with us so far and for tuning into another episode of All Things Policy.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.